The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
Come on, Jerome!
We'll fight in another state!
Are you gonna dodge the draft?
I ain't draft dodging, I ain't burning no flag, and I ain't running to Canada. I'm staying right here. You want to send me to jail? Fine, you go right ahead. I've been in jail for 400 years. I could be there for four or five more. But I ain't going no 10,000 miles to help murder and kill other poor people. If I want to die, I'll die right here, right now, fighting you. If I want to die, you my enemy. Not no Chinese, no Viet Cong, no Japanese. You my poser when I want freedom. You my poser when I want justice. You my poser when I want equality. Want me to go somewhere and fight for you? You won't even stand up for me right here in America. For my rights and my religious beliefs. You won't even stand up for me right here at home.
Hey everyone, another Loose Cannons podcast coming at you. Today we're going to be discussing 2001's Ali, directed by Michael Mann. Before we do that, though, let's introduce a guest joining us today, Michael Dwyer, back on the podcast. What is this, your fourth time?
Fourth or fifth, I think, actually. Somewhere.
I think you've definitely got the clear lead.
You and Marsha are going back and forth on that one.
If there were a Wikipedia page, I would say Twilo champion.
Twilo.
True. Or an IMDb page that listed how many episodes each person would be in. It'd be the first one that's not the four of us.
As always, you can find our content on loosecannons.net, LOOSECANONS.net. We've got podcasts, we've got videos, we've got writings, we've got it all. Those are the three things that constitute the entire content universe. As I mentioned already, today we're going to be discussing 2001's Ali, directed by Michael Mann, but before we do that, let's do this, a little segment we like to call Heralds and Denouncements. Patrick, as per usual, why don't you kick us off?
I would like to denounce the movie A Brilliant Young Mind. That's a film from this year. It's kind of a hybrid of an issues movie, but also it's a little bit of like an underdog sports story too. It follows this young kid who is autistic, played by Asa Butterfield, and he's supposed to be trying to compete in like this math Olympiad in England. He even has like an old disgruntled teacher who used to be a math elite and was like fell out of favor and was disgraced, and he's basically that character.
You're the man now, dog.
he's basically that character from the Mitchell and Webley sketch who's like, "A boulder wide in the ashes." Like, that's exactly who that character is. It has all the worst tropes of those two genres too, where it's like, oh, it's about how he sees the world differently because he's autistic, but then it's also like he's an underdog and he's gotta, you know, prove that he's the best at math or whatever. And it also just doesn't have an ending. Like, the movie just sort of like it basically ends with him and his mom like deciding to go after the girl that he likes, and that's it, that's the end of the movie. Like, they don't resolve that conflict in any way. It's
like in Good Will Hunting, he drives off, you don't know whether or not they really got together.
Oh, but dear god, it's such a like bland piece of garbage. I couldn't handle it.
Yeah, when you said the title, I was gonna say, is it a sequel to A Beautiful Mind? But
that's what I was thinking too. I was like, oh no, they're doing that kind of thing again too. It's like all the just really generic tropes of that genre just smashed together, and it's really underwhelming. So yeah, that was part of my my five movies in one day adventure that I had.
Sounds pretty the good. I haven't watched that many in a long time. To get back to it.
I only do that because I'm bad at watching them regularly. So I just have to, like, binge.
Binge, watch, binge, watch.
I only ended up liking one movie that I saw that day, too.
That's a bummer.
Which was kind of sad. Documentaries saved the day in the end.
You and your docs. I will go ahead and herald Michael Mann's Manhunter. Speaking of Michael Mann, since we're watching a Michael Mann movie for today, I watched Manhunter a few days ago and really liked it a lot. It's got some cool neon, some cool, sometimes cheesy synths. Some fun doubling effects. You know, the whole movie is basically about, as with a lot of Michael Mann movies, pitting two apparently disparate sides and analyzing how they're actually pretty close to each other when we come down to it. You know, criminals and not criminals. In this case, it's serial murderers and FBI agents who investigate those serial murderers. And does some pretty fun stuff, and I really like the cinematography a lot. It's Dante Spinotti, but before he got a little annoying. So it worked well together. I don't know. Dante Spinotti is not bad, but I always think of Funny People and how obnoxious looking that movie is for like a weird Adam Sandler pseudo comedy. And I think it's mostly thanks to him.
A lot of Michael Mann happening this year.
Yep. Also think
on the list.
Based on this, you know, anyone with the last name Mann should at some point in their career direct a movie that also has Mann in the title, because it's one of their better ones when they do.
Michael Mann's Self-Hunter.
What is Anthony Mann's Mann movie?
Man of the West.
Okay. Yeah, I like that movie. Yeah,
exactly.
Nice.
I think I might be the only person who actually prefers Red Dragon, but I'm also,
I haven't seen Manhunter. I've only seen Red Dragon, and I don't really like it.
I haven't seen either of them.
I haven't seen Red Dragon.
I normally don't like serial killer movies, so.
Yeah. I think I'm in that boat, too. I'm pretty over serial killers.
Yeah, cut it out already, guys. Nobody cares anymore.
No, don't cut it out that way. No, stop.
Poor murder.
Okay, Michael, do you
have... Yeah, I will herald...
Movie you'd like to herald?
Oh, I will herald James Whale's Frankenstein from 1931. One of the 31 horror movies I'm watching this year. I really, really liked it. And I thought it was super cool, and I'd never seen it.
Are they all from 1931? I hope so.
I don't know if they made 31 movies in 1931, did they?
Well, they made hundreds, but maybe not 31 horror movies.
Yeah, and maybe probably not 100 are available still.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say maybe not 100 of them survived.
Like 50 or 60 most. Well, no, that's not true, because What's-His-Face watches like 300 movies from every year.
It's true.
Punked.
What's his face?
Isn't that his name? Punked?
It's just Punk. Punk. Not the TV show starring Ashton.
Well,
whichever.
But yeah. P-U-N-Q. Punk. He's watched like over 300 movies from almost every year since movies started being made.
My God.
It's a very intense practice. He has, like, almost 20,000
movies
logged.
I mean, he's in, like,
logged.
The 30s.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he hasn't... It's not like he's caught up to movie making yet, but, yeah. He watches several hundred movies from every year, starting in, whatever, 1892.
92. Something like that.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So
it is.
I would go so far as to say that's literally crazy. It's not a stretch to say.
The smell in his apartment must be atrocious.
Wrong with him. Fair enough.
He has a wife, apparently. I feel bad for her.
Oh my god. I assumed he was like a child.
No, I've read some of his reviews, and one of them he referenced his girlfriend, and then he didn't reference her again in anything, so I was like, oh, maybe they broke up, that makes sense. But then in a recent review he said his wife, and I was like, oh, I guess they didn't break up, they did the opposite. She was like, I like this so much, I want to commit to it forever.
I guess she's not logging the movies, but she's sitting there with him watching 10 movies.
Oh, that's
a
bold maneuver on her part.
Maybe he just really has his shit together. I don't know. It's hard to tell if he's.
Or maybe
just...
she's supporting him. She's like, I love him so much, and I love what he's doing. I'm gonna work all the time, so that he can watch 10 movies.
That could go. I feel like that could go either way. Like, what's his job? Is he like a film historian? Maybe that's
why
he's.
He did a review once where he where he said that he wasn't gonna be able to keep doing this next year because he was running out of money. So.
Ah. Well, that makes sense.
But he does have the Guinness Book of World Records for most feature films seen in a year, and he broke his own record several times in a row.
Hmm. Wow.
That's not like
I hope he's not listening to this. We've been going on and on about this poor guy from Norway who's probably...
I just assumed that he was like somebody who just had to watch movies for a living and just like took it all the way.
10 movies a day. What else could he do? Though, like,
if you were like
a historian
who had to like, you know, like watch this, make sure it's good, like watch this print, you know, or something like that. Like, I could totally see, like, all right, that's what I got to do. I just got to watch these old prints, make sure they're okay.
I'm sure he'd love to have that job if it exists.
Yeah, you don't do anything after you watch the movies. You just watch them.
Okay, well, Ruben, do you have anything to herald or denounce?
I sure do. I get to herald a movie that was recommended to me by fellow podcaster Patrick called How to Survive a Plague from 2012, directed by some people. I'll look it up.
David France.
I thought there were two directors. Just one? Oh. David France.
That's the only one listed on Letterboxd.
Okay, this is a documentary about ACT UP, the organization that was created in the 80s to sort of fight the political grid and economic gridlock over the AIDS crisis. The sort of most obvious point of comparison is Harlan County. You take a marginalized group, you take a lot of real footage of them in the act of doing good social work, and you know, it becomes an interesting story. But I would actually say that I would compare this more to Ross McElwee's work in terms of why I like it as a documentary. There's some real cool humanity going on here that's very exposed in a way that I think is pretty well done. In fact, if I were to have a complaint about it, I would say that it does kind of a poor job of being the type of thing Harlan County is, which I feel like gets a lot of information out there and sort of makes its points, and it's far more believable as like a convincing document of the change that they made when they unionized. Whereas this, you know, they make a lot of claims that they are not really able to back up in any sort of way. But in spite of that, I guess characters are so nuanced and interesting that I ended up really liking the movie.
Yep.
Cool.
Some really like hard hitting scenes too, emotionally speaking, in the movie.
Yeah.
I think it has one of my favorite, like, I don't know, like big emotional reveals in a documentary, because usually when they do that kind of thing where it's like they withhold information about somebody until the very end, and then they're like, surprise. You know, it always seems cheesy to me when they do it in documentaries, but in this one, like, there's a character who you're not sure is if they're alive or dead, if you don't mm-hmm. know the stories of these people, and so they wait until the very end to, like, reveal that they're still alive, and I was just like, it got me. I was just like, ah, you did it, you got me. Mm-hmm. That's a very good emotional reversal.
He has a really good quote that'll probably make it into the montage at that point, where he says, like any war, you wonder why you came home.
Yeah, it's just like a beautiful, beautiful movie.
Survivor's guilt.
It's a great movie.
Like shrouded in darkness right now. I should probably turn on some lights.
The only one who hasn't seen it.
Still relevant today too, I think. There's a lot of parallels between what was going on then and what's going on now, at least in terms of medication pricing and stuff like that, without getting too technical or into it.
Inside baseball from the pharmacist.
That's right. Inside baseball. But I mean, if you pay attention to the news, you can see what's going on with some of those hepatitis medications or with the medications for toxoplasmosis that was in the news recently.
I did see some of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was a big enough deal.
Of course, there was that big story recently about that guy that everyone hates now because he raised like that price of that one medication. I think it was an AIDS medication, like 1,000% or something.
Yeah, it's
like
a medication they use to treat toxoplasmosis, which is a common, it's an infection you can get quite commonly if you have AIDS. So, sort of an AIDS medication. So, people with AIDS.
The only thing I know about toxoplasmosis is that guy gets it from having a cat and a baby and train spotting. Because you can get it from cat poop.
Yeah, so movie's still relevant, even though it's like from like the people. Well, the story happened about 30 years ago. It's still not. It's still a problem.
If it seems like we're stretching right now, we are, because Patrick just dropped out and now he's back.
Yay. That happens.
All right, Basil.
All right, let's get into this plot description. Describe some plot for Ollie. All right. So this is sort of structurally pretty standard biopic. It picks a certain point to pick up with Muhammad Ali's life when he's still Cassius Clay and he's training for his first like really big run at the title, and kind of continues through him winning the title and then deciding to change his name to Muhammad Ali and really commit himself to the Muslim faith that's rising in the 70s and the United States, and then potentially being banned from boxing altogether, and sort of culminates in his famous Rumble in the Jungle fight against George Foreman, and that's sort of where the movie ends. Obviously, since it's a biopic and it doesn't end with his death, there's lots of title cards at the end that explain the things that he did after the movie is over, and yeah, that's pretty much it. You know, covers his two marriages. There's a lot of scenes in this movie. It's pretty long. 2 hours and 45 minutes, I think, is the version that I watched.
I think I watched one that was a little bit shorter than that. I watched one that was 2:36 or something like that.
Yeah, I watched the director's cut.
Ah. So I think I watched the theatrical cut.
Yep. I talked it over with Ruben earlier. We're going to go scene by scene and talk about what happens so that we can figure out what's different about the two versions.
Perfect idea for a podcast that nobody can see.
I'll just describe what happens and be like, did you guys see this part?
Did you guys see that dog running by in the background? Oh no, that must just be in the director's cut. Oh man, that dog is pretty awesome. Mm-hmm.
Really
I like dogs.
Me too. All right, so Michael, what did you think of this movie?
I did not like it. I thought it was really, I guess the word would be morose, for something that was supposed to be a celebration of somebody's life and their accomplishments. It felt really dreary and depressing. And I just was not a fan of it. It was pretty to look at times, but other than that, I just was not into it.
All right.
Yeah, sorry.
There were some things that I liked and some things that I didn't like, so I ended up being fairly indifferent to the movie. I felt like, in a lot of ways, as Basil sort of hinted at, it was a fairly typical biopic narratively. There was a lot of stuff that felt like it was included just because it was in Ollie's life that I never felt like added to the movie whatsoever. So, like Michael said, Manuel Lubezki and Michael Mann working together can make a very pretty film, but it was very long and there was a lot of stuff that I thought could be cut.
Yeah, I also felt like, like Michael said, I got the sense that it wanted to be like really serious about everything, and even the scenes that were supposed to be, you know, scenes of Muhammad Ali doing his famous bit where he's, you know, like verbally sparring with people and joking around, felt like they had this, I don't know, this like pall over them where they were just kind of like, this is still a serious movie. Like, even though he's being funny right now, it's still a serious movie. And I think part of that was, I don't know if this is the case, but it felt like Will Smith, instead of playing like Ali being kind of scared as an undercurrent, like played it as the foreground of the character. He always seemed scared in every scene where he did that sort of stuff, and I was like, but that's kind of the flipped version of the way that people really remember that stuff. It was just like Ali, you know, put on this front of being like, you know, he was like really jovial, and you know, I don't know if that was like a deliberate choice, but it distracted me in a way that I didn't really enjoy Will Smith's performance that much.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with what everyone said so far, but I think I found his performance sort of distracting. He's like doing kind of a voice the whole time, which I always find a little annoying while watching a biopic, but I guess it's pretty standard for actors. And yeah, the way it started out with him running, I was like, oh, this is gonna be really cool, because it's like really obviously shot on early 2000s digital, and it's really and I was like, this is weird for a movie that takes place in 1964 to have like such an obviously contemporary look to it. But then I don't think Michael Mann really did anything that interesting with that. And as everyone else kind of said, it's just kind of a drab movie. Like, I spent a lot of the second half waiting for it to be over. I was like, oh, this is kind of boring. I don't know why I'm seeing all these scenes. And I don't know. Yeah, it's just, it didn't feel like it had the kind of exciting energy that I often expect from Michael Mann. And I watched The Insider earlier this year and felt the same way, although I liked that movie a little bit more. But I guess, this era was Michael Mann really trying to prove his credibility and win an Oscar or something, and that's a side of his character that does not look good on him, as it doesn't with most directors.
Yeah, my feelings about the acting were like, there were a lot of performances that I thought were good in a vacuum, like Will Smith's. I was like, this is an interesting performance, and he like creates a character here with depth, but then I was like, but it's not Muhammad Ali, so I didn't like it.
Right.
So, like, and I felt that about, like, a lot of the performances. I was like, if this were a fictional movie that Michael Mann had made, I would probably like a lot of these performances better. But that, with a lot of the famous characters, I was like, I don't know. They didn't feel like they fit the actual historical narrative in a way.
Yeah, I found John Voight very distracting. As Howard Cosell. I mean, I guess Cosell's like such a weird persona in general that, like, it's hard to imagine him hanging out in real life because he's such a, like, weird mannered way of speaking, but...
I would have loved to have seen the Howard Cosell biopic. Cosell.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually found him the, like, I don't know, the least distracting of the, like, big personalities here because, I don't know, I thought the guy that played Malcolm X also was a little too, like, morose. Like, he was just a little too, I don't know, like, fatalistic a little bit. I guess we're picking up, and, you know, I just saw Spike Lee's Malcolm X, so I'm comparing it to Pretty Big Shoes.
Yeah.
But he just felt like, you know, like stone-faced the whole time, and you didn't ever get to see anything else from that character. And I guess that's all, you know, he's just, again, like Ruben said, like, it's just there because that was part of Muhammad Ali's life, but it doesn't really fit into anything else in the story. It's just a reason for him to be sad at some point.
I felt that way most strongly about Bundini?
Oh, Jamie Foxx's character, yeah, Bundini, yeah.
It's like, oh, like when he's drinking earlier surreptitiously, I'm like, oh, okay, we're going to have to deal with his alcoholism at some point, even though I don't care. I don't care about this character. I don't know why Muhammad Ali is friends with him. I have no connection to him whatsoever. He's just in here.
Yeah, I thought there was a more interesting point to be made about his character, which was that Muhammad Ali seemed to get a lot of his, and I don't know if this was, if it was trying to make that connection, but it seemed like he got a lot of the way that he, like, used rhymes and stuff like that from Bundini, because Bundini seemed to speak in that sort of, like, you know, really poetic kind of way. And I thought it would have been more interesting if they had actually, like, tied that together, been like, yeah, Bundini had this other, like, impact on Muhammad Ali, where he actually, like, maybe shaped the way that he speaked a little bit, or with the way that he spoke a little bit.
There is a...
Yeah, I thought... I was going to say, I thought that it was weird that they didn't get into any of that for a movie that covers such a huge span of his life. Like, it sort of starts with him having already adopted that persona of, like, speaking to the public in rhymes and everything. And I'm like, I already know that he does this, but I want to know, like, why Muhammad Ali, like, the person decided, you know, it'd be cool if I just, like, spoke in rhymes whenever I was, like, making fun of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get any sense of, like, who he was as a character and, like, why that was, like, his shtick. Like, why did he decide to do that? And I felt that way about a lot of his choices. I was like, I don't know. I feel like I watched a 2-hour and 45-minute movie about Muhammad Ali, and I don't really understand who he was as a person any better than I did before I saw this movie.
Yeah, and they choose to focus on, like, I don't know, stuff like he was a womanizer, and it's like, well, yeah, but, I mean, that's a trait that I've seen applied to, like, I don't know, endless amounts of male protagonists and things, and you're just like, that's not interesting to see that kind of thing applied. It's just like, oh, okay, he liked women a lot. He cheated on his wife. Okay. That's not really that interesting.
I agree. But... And also I feel like Michael Mann was trying to do something sort of cultural commentary, because I feel like in a lot of parts of the movie, Ali's, like, not even the main character. It's sort of focused on this weird conspiratorial tone of, like, the government is watching them, and there's all these things going on, which is very similar to the Insider, rather.
But it never went anywhere in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
a pretty tacked-on sort of thing here.
Well, the weirdest part was when they had Howard Cosell playing, like, the Deep Throat character and phoning Muhammad Ali from the sound booth in the studio. It's like, what the hell was that? Like, I don't know if that actually happened or not, but it was just bizarre. Like, and he was giving him, like, he was, like, they were, you know, whispering about Muhammad, you know.
Like coded information.
Giving him secret information. Like, is Howard Cosell, like, did he really have the inside line on all this stuff? I kind of feel like he didn't.
He was a pretty great reporter.
Yeah.
I'm with Patrick, though, by the way. I liked Howard John Boyd as Howard Cosell.
Oh. I mean, I liked it. I didn't even recognize that it was him. I was like, I guess that's... Like, the makeup was obviously makeup, but at the same time, like, I wasn't until the credits that I was like, oh, that was John Voight. I guess I did see his name in the opening credits and just forgot it.
Oh, no. Go ahead with what you were going to say. So I was going to
move to I was just going to say that I felt like the one thing that I thought was done really well in this movie or that I liked was, like, the difference between public and private personas and, like, how Howard and Holly were, like, had a tense public relationship, and then in private they were actually, like, good friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the scene with Joe Frazier, too, where they're riding around Philly, and they're, like, scheduling this fight that's going to be really important to both of their lives. And then he's like, hey, man, I heard you're broke. Do you need any money?
Yeah. I was going to say, I liked that, too. I liked those, like, private moments. The stuff that you don't, like, really know about in the lore of Muhammad Ali, which was kind of cool, which, you know, seeing that he was, like, good friends with Joe Frazier and stuff like that.
I wish they could have pulled that together with all the characters, because I agree, I like that part a lot. But, I like, the part when there's, like, a rift between him and Malcolm X, like, I didn't understand it. I was like, why is Ali siding with, like, this Muslim faith when... seeing Malcolm X was ostensibly the reason that he got involved with it to begin with. Mm-hmm. Like, what is motivating him to be like, you shouldn't have gone against whatever?
Well, it came so out of nowhere. It wasn't telegraphed at all. Like, there was,
like,
no development.
Like, hey, you shouldn't have done that.
He just all of a sudden just said, you shouldn't have gone against Elijah Muhammad. But it wasn't, there was no development of the...
Of his thought process. Yeah, he's just like, it's just like immediately he turns.
It's
just like,
it made
just there to create drama.
It artificially sort of inserted to create drama. Maybe it did happen that way, but there should have been. But it's a movie, right? Like,
yeah.
I'm pretty sure I watched a movie.
I'm not sure.
I can't say definitively. I thought it was funny that they got the guy who played Elijah Muhammad's assistant and Malcolm X to play Elijah Muhammad in this.
I did think there were a lot of callbacks actually to Malcolm X, because especially when he pulls his car over after he hears that Malcolm X has been shot, and then like A Change Is Gonna Come is playing on the radio or whatever.
Yeah.
Or it's on the soundtrack anyway, and I was like, they're referencing Malcolm X pretty hard right now.
Oh man, that's such a good moment. What a great song. I really like.
Yeah.
I don't know. Every time I hear that song, it almost makes me cry. And I really like the way Spike Lee uses it, even if it's like sort of over the top. I feel like in a lesser director's hand, that moment could be really heavy-handed, but it really works for me in that movie.
Yep.
I think part of the reason why I really like it is because that little interaction with the woman as he's on the way to the church, and like they're bringing it down to like the real human nature of it. She's like, you keep doing the work, we love you. And he's like, thank you.
Go ahead.
I was gonna say, also tying it back into just having seen Malcolm X, I think that the way that Spike Lee uses music is so much better than the way Michael Mann uses music, because I feel like Michael Mann foregrounds it in such a way that it just feels, I don't know, it kind of hits you over the head a little bit more. And I don't know, I didn't really enjoy his musical selection a lot in this movie, although I kind of enjoyed the earlier scenes where he's like intercutting Sam Cooke and Ali like training. But again, like, I don't understand what it has to do with the rest of the movie. I was like, oh, is this going to be like a motif he keeps coming back to? But then it's like, not really, because Sam Cooke just sort of disappears. Yeah. I don't even know why Sam Cooke is in the movie at all, other than he's just in Muhammad Ali's life.
Doesn't he see him right after the end of the first boxing match, and he says, "Hey, Sam Cooke is here," and then that's it.
It's like, why? I suppose that really happened.
It's one of the worst things about biopics, when they just have famous people just walk through a scene, you know.
Yeah.
They did that with Malcolm X and Selma, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Malcolm X scene. He's barely in it. Necessary. Yeah, the only thing that's good about the Malcolm X scene at Selma is that the guy they cast to play him looks exactly like Malcolm X.
That's creepy, yeah.
And they have Maya Angelou is in this movie, just like off screen. He's just like, Maya Angelou over there, like, okay, just dropping names.
You would almost think that this was a satire of biopics if it went further, but I don't think it goes far enough to be that.
Yeah, for a while, I was like, oh, maybe this is on purpose. Maybe he's, Michael Mann's trying to make a broader statement that, like, biopics are bullshit and we can never really understand the interiority of a famous person through, like, looking at their life, but he doesn't go anywhere near far enough to really make that a real thing.
Yeah. And I think you could make that point in less than 2 hours and 45 minutes, if that's the point you wanted to make as
well.
That's
probably true.
Feel like that could be a lean hour and 30 minute good film.
That's true.
Yeah, he also seems to dwell on stuff that he really, like, he seems like he wants to drive home a little too hard. And I'm thinking specifically of the scene where Muhammad Ali is running in Zaire with all the people around him, and he comes to the wall where they've, like, painted him on the wall, and it's, you know, it says, like, Ali, kill him on the wall, and it's, you know,
it's
like
Mumbai.
This... But yeah, whatever the word is that they've painted there, but that, like, it seems like the point that Mann wants to make there is like, oh, you're an avatar for all these people. Like they see you as, you know, you're as like a projection of them on the rest of the world, and like the point is made, but he just like holds that moment for so long. Like they just keep cutting back to reaction shots of Will Smith, like looking really seriously at the wall, and then back to the wall, and then back to Will Smith, and then back to the wall.
And then back
like,
to the guy
I
with
got
the radio.
It. I got it. Let's move on. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like,
we got it.
Looks
Let's
good.
Move on. We don't have to let this entire song play.
And also it doesn't really add that much because we also don't really know why they picked Ali for that. Like,
it's, yeah, you never get an explanation of why.
Of why Ali as opposed to Foreman?
He's the best.
Yeah.
He's the best is why.
But he's not really, because George Foreman just, like, beat him a few years later or whatever. Like...
No. I mean, personally, Muhammad Ali is the best.
Oh, he is really cool. Okay, I got him. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense in real life, but we don't get a sense of who that person is when watching the movie.
Jumping back a little bit, I just want to make something clear. Patrick said Spike Lee uses music better than Michael Mann. That could still mean that Michael Mann is good at using music because Spike Lee is one of the best. Michael Mann is not good at using music. There's a big difference between Spike Lee and Michael Mann's use of music.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
I sometimes like the way Michael Mann uses scores, but I almost never like the way that he uses actual popular songs. It's almost always really bad.
I think he just doesn't have good taste in popular music, honestly. Because all of the popular music that I've heard in his movies, I'm just like, I mean, the Sam Cooke stuff is good, but again, like, he's putting that in there because Sam Cooke was, I guess, really new Muhammad Ali, and he's not putting it in there because he thought, you know what would go great here? Sam Cooke.
Yeah.
He's putting it in there, you know.
Also, it's really weird. Isn't it not really Sam Cooke, but someone, like, doing a karaoke version? Like, it's not, like, an actor lip-syncing to a real recording.
It's definitely not, yeah, it's not the real version of those songs, for sure.
Which is very strange, like, I feel like
I mean, that would play into that whole biopic parody thing, I think, but again, we all agree he doesn't go far enough to actually get there.
And he's not, I don't know, yeah, he's definitely not biting in any way.
Like a copy of a copy of a copy.
His use of the score wasn't even that good in this movie, though, I thought. Like, just the, like, dramatic swells during the fight were just, like, it just felt so, like, hacky.
I,
very
yeah,
history.
Like,
yeah.
This is the important part, like.
Yeah, they're in the first...
Yeah, but, like, I like the music in Black Hat, the score.
I think during the first fight scene, I was kind of enthralled by the way he was shooting it, just with no music, just with, you just hear, like, the punches hitting.
Yeah, that was
you know, people cheering and stuff like that. And
I thought the first fight was the best part.
Yeah.
My favorite part of all the fights, actually, it was how he would light the ring so much that when he exposed it to the ring, you couldn't see anything else past the ring except for the other lights, which were just like, they kind of looked like they were on a spaceship or something. Just these lights drifting off just into nowhere.
Yeah, just went on forever.
And there was no one watching.
The first fight was by far the best part, but then it, like, towards the end of the fight, he did start to insert music underneath, and it just totally undercut the tension because you could tell exactly what was going to happen.
Yeah, that was, I was going to make that same observation. Like, I was like, oh, I kind of like the way that the only way you can really tell whether something like good or bad is happening is like just watching, you know, the way that they're hitting each other, and also like the crowd going like, ah. And I like the crowd swells as like an indicator of what was going, you know, right and wrong about the fight. But then, like, yeah, you, like you said, once you get the music, you know exactly like how you're supposed to feel about everything that's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, except for I feel like the guy who plays Liston, his performance is totally in tension with that. I felt like the way he looked was so sad when he was getting beaten that I was like, oh, I can't feel excited for this. Like, this is like a guy who really wants to win, and he's just like getting his ass beat, and it looks really sad. Like, and then I was like, is that supposed to be the point? Is, but then again, like, because everything in this movie feels so wishy-washy, I was like, I can't tell if Michael Mann's doing that on purpose or if the actor's just like turning in a good performance where he should be doing something else, like, to make us feel like, yeah, you go, Ali, instead of being like, oh, it's sad that boxing involves one person punching another one until they're really hurt.
Yeah, yeah, that is true.
Or both of them are hurt.
Yeah,
I was going to say,
Ali did not live a great life after about 40 or so when he started getting severe brain issues.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't understand why Jeffrey Wright's character was in this movie.
Who is that?
He just, it seemed like he was gonna, he was the
his
photographer.
Brother?
He was the photographer. I was like, I thought he was gonna have a bigger role, but then he just sort of stays in the background and is just like taking pictures.
That felt like,
and the, like, occasionally,
I feel like that's what Jeffrey Wright does though.
But occasionally they'll cut to him and he'll be like, come on. Like, that's it. That's
that felt him. Like Michael Mann was basically saying, see, I remember this photo from like Time magazine or Life magazine too, like, this is the, this is that important photograph, like, wink.
And I'll bet you didn't know that it was his brother that took it. I don't know.
Of the surrounding people though, I'm most bothered by Ron Silver, who I continue to not like as an actor.
Was he his coach guy who's like,
yeah,
the Italian-American coach?
Makes sense.
Yeah, and he's my biggest complaint about
Angie.
Two movies I like, Blue Steel and Time Cop.
Time Cop. Good old Time Cop.
It kind of works in Time Cop because it's such an over-the-top, silly movie. And
sure.
He plays the villain.
Same matter can't occupy the same space.
True. I believe Muhammad Ali said I know what Basil was saying, and I definitely felt that about his name change too, and it really bothered me that the film wasn't willing to go like 100% on the side of him changing his name was good. Like, he kept having his father like argue with him and try to make him feel bad about, you know, like separating himself from the family, and I was like, no, he's really right about this. Like, that's not his name. It was a name that was forced on him by a really awful past, and changing his name is an act of revolution. That's but it kept like, it tried to make him petty when he got really upset at that one guy who called him Clay, and, you know, I didn't like that.
Yeah.
I don't, although I kind of did enjoy that. Like, I enjoyed how angry he got in that fight, like, where he just, like, beat the crap out of the guy and kept being like, say my name, you know?
Yeah, I didn't think it came off as petty.
Yeah, but it made him seem kind of petty, though.
I I don't know, though. It was at least different from what that character had done before, though. So it was some difference, because I feel like he doesn't really change gears a lot in that performance, and it was actually a part of the performance where it felt like real for whatever reason. Like, I actually felt like Will Smith playing him was like changing gears, and he was like, all right, like, now I'm gonna get mad at this guy, like, you know, I'm gonna call him a motherfucker, and yeah, you know, I'm gonna which I liked. I was like, all right, he's doing something different here. He's finally not just being, you know, morose all the time.
Yeah, I feel like the, well, I don't know. I mean, this is just another thing where sorry, I started to talk and then it looked like Patrick froze, so I stopped talking, but anyway,
I'll just constantly move so you can tell when I'm frozen.
Alright, will do. For some reason, every single person looked like they were, like, very still, so I got nervous that I was the one that got disconnected. And I was like, oh, I better stop talking in case other people are talking right now. But, anyway, it was just another thing where, like, they don't go far enough to explain the kind of psychological motivation, so the moment ends up not working. When he, breaks up with his first wife, I was like, oh, this could be really interesting, because she, like, wants to be her own person and dress the way she wants, and he's so, like, worried about public perception of him as, like, part of this, like, burgeoning Muslim movement that, like, to him it's sort of, like, opens up a place where the media could attack him to have this wife who, you know, is sort of dressing in the more, like, 60s typical straightened hair, like, black woman look, but then they don't, like, go anywhere with that. There's just, like, one scene where they fight and then they break up forever, and I was like, that's it? Like, and it especially made me sad, because I was gonna say that Jada Smith is actually my favorite performance in the movie. I really like her as an actor in general, and I thought she was good in this. And also Magic Mike XXL, which is my favorite part of that movie.
And in Bamboozled.
I still haven't seen that one. But
she's
I
my
want
favorite
to.
Part of Bamboozled.
Nice.
It's a really sad comment on a movie, though, that, like, it's, like, 2 hours and 40 minutes almost, and they can't, like, develop a single idea like that, right? Like, I mean, it's not even that complicated of an idea, but it just doesn't get enough time to be developed. Like, part of the problem, I think, with the movie is just that it tries to cover way too much ground. Like, there's so many things going on in his life through, like, this period that none of them get enough time to really, like, be developed as an idea. Like, don't...
Yeah, and there's no... I mean, I feel like biopics get shit on a lot for covering a lot of ground over a person's life, but I think that Malcolm X and other successful biopics prove that if you have, like, a sort of central idea, you can cover a large swath of time while being committed to, like, a few small, like, very well-honed ideas. Mm-hmm. But I feel like, yeah, as you said, like, Michael Mann's trying to jump all over all kinds of different ideas and can't really pick one to solidify enough to even,
like,
make a solid point.
Exactly.
On.
Like, you could have made an entire movie just about the Rumble in the Jungle segment. Like, you could have made a 2-hour and 37 minute movie just about that, like, about a guy just trying to reclaim his, you know, his lost sort of glory, and that would have made,
yeah, someone actually made a documentary about,
yeah,
that.
Was it any good?
It's called When We Were Kings, so it's,
I've heard it's really good.
I haven't seen it,
yeah.
I haven't seen it, but I was thinking about it when I was like, oh, this, I kind of want to watch that documentary now.
Colin, who was maybe going to be on this podcast, has seen both and prefers When We Were Kings to Ali.
So, you're right. You could just make a movie about that segment.
And
someone has.
I would want to see the Vietnam War stuff personally, because that's what I'm most interested in. But
that,
almost any part of this film could
That does seem like the part where the movie is actually at its, I guess, most incendiary,
Well, it speaks to me the most, especially the way in which, like, in this movie, it's not as clear from the beginning that he's definitely going to go for it, like the Vietnam stuff. I mean, we probably all know the history, but it doesn't make it seem like he decided that from, like, the very beginning, that he's, you know, at least considering the other options. And I thought that was interesting, especially considering, you know, his public response is so outspoken.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I liked all his response and stuff, but again, I don't feel like we ever see the, like, internal process of how he comes to that decision. Like, it just...
For sure.
Yeah, he just does it in the scene when it happens. He just starts saying all of it. And you're like, where did all this come from?
Yeah, like, presumably a lot of it maybe came from his delving into the teachings of the Nation of Islam, but his interaction with them is, like, almost nothing. But it was a huge part of his life, right? Like, it's how he got his new name. It's how he came to meet Malcolm X, who was a huge part of the first part of the movie, but it's not really given any context within sort of, you know.
Yeah, and it feels like they are almost, like, adversarial the whole time. Like, the rest of the Nation of Islam is just kind of, like, this background figure who he kind of doesn't like almost from the beginning, who's kind of, like, pushing him around and making him do stuff. And, or at least the movie that makes them feel adversarial to us.
They did become kind of adversarial type.
They were definitely adversarial, but, like, even from the beginning, I feel like the movie's already setting up, like, our distrust of them through the character of Malcolm X, where it's like he can't trust them, and he's obviously Ali's friend, so we're also meant to not trust them. And
I almost laughed pretty hard at that earlier scene in the hotel when him and Ali were first talking about it, and he says, out of nowhere, the Malcolm X character says, "You ever thought you'd lose it, like really lose it?" And I was like, "What does that even mean? What are you talking about? In what context?" Although I did really like that Ali couldn't stop talking about the termites. That scene. So I started off really liking that scene because I was like, "You're right, termites are pretty interesting, Mom and Ali."
Yeah, I liked the way that was cut, where he's like, "I'm watching this thing on these termites. Look at this termite ate these people's house," and then it cuts to the stock footage of a house falling down. I was like, that seems really funny, and nothing else in the movie ever really comes that close to being that comical again.
There are some funny parts. I like when he was first with Jada Pinkett Smith, and he's like, "You've got a pretty face for a lady, but you've never been with a pretty face as pretty as mine."
You just have some very funny sayings.
But he was such like a funny and clever guy, but that, like, doesn't really come across. Yeah. He comes across almost as being just an asshole, right? Like, maybe he was, but...
Maybe I'm taking my own personal feelings into it too much, but I didn't feel like he was an asshole. I didn't think that he was as funny as I think he was in real life, because, you know, like, the stuff about being, like, scared and stuff that you've all brought up and how much the movie is about that makes it, you know, seem more, again, I guess, petty or defensive that he's so funny, as opposed to, like, I don't know, just being a genuinely funny person, which I think he is. Sure, it was. Yeah, I know where Vietnam is. It's on TV.
Yeah, and I wish the movie had done a better job, at least, of, I don't know, in a way, it doesn't deal with it at all, but it's too bad that it doesn't, because I feel like his, like, mental illness, I don't know what else to call it, but, like, you know, the brain damage and everything like that, sort of turned Muhammad Ali into, like, almost like a whitewashed character, where, like, people like my dad, who obviously would have vehemently, like, hated him in the 70s, can now, like, get behind him as, like, oh, Muhammad Ali, this, like, tragic figure who was a great fighter and, Now Look at Him or it's whatever.
Great American Hero, man.
Yeah. And they leave out, like, a lot of people think that that happened because of his last fight that he had with Larry Holmes, because it was just a, like, it was just basically a cash grab for all the people who were promoting him. And that's also, like, another interesting wrinkle in this character that they don't ever get to, and that I don't even think they even mention it in here, but there's actually a whole documentary about it that Alfred Maisel's made, called Muhammad and Larry. It's one that ended up being one of the ESPN 30 for 30s. It was like one that they shot back when the fight was happening, and then they never got to like make the movie, and so ESPN like gave the money to finish editing it and stuff, and so they put it out as one of the 30 for 30 documentaries. So that exists.
If you love documentaries so much, why don't you just marry them?
I will. I'm going to marry Harlan County, USA.
At least you're going to marry my second favorite documentary.
I was trying to think of a really bad documentary to use as a counterexample, but...
I'm going to marry Super Size Me.
An American movie.
Yeah. American movie. Those are both good examples.
No problem.
Or Chronicon, episode 420, a new dope.
Yep. Not just my favorite documentary, but my third favorite movie of all time.
Time Indefinite?
Chronicon.
Nope.
Yes, Time Indefinite is the one that is one the real. Those...
The real answer. The non-joke
what
answer.
What about one of those David Icke or like Alex Jones documentaries?
I don't know what that is.
You're missing out, Ruben.
Oh, God. Alex Jones. It's like that crazy right-wing guy, right?
Oh, yeah. That sounds good.
Oh, boy.
Like...
Little bully.
The ones with like... The movie's called like Freedom and then the D is backwards or something.
It's got Freedom and it's got a D minus or something in it. Like, we get a D minus.
Yeah.
Or Obama's America.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, with a K instead of a C.
Oh, my God. Oh, well.
I'm glad they've reached the, like, linguistic cleverness of Crazy Cat from the 1930s.
Of 1930s comic strips. Good job, guys. You made it. Well, I'm all
out. We should make the movie that it seems like this movie was maybe trying to be, the movie about how biopics can't capture a real person's life.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I wouldn't have put it past Mann for that to be like something that he had in mind. He is a smart dude, but I feel like maybe his desire to make something that could actually win an award came in tension with his entire desire to like make an actually good movie.
Yeah,
thankfully he's given that up and now his movies make zero money.
It's true, but they're really good, so I'm happy, even if his investors are not.
Yeah, I felt like also this movie kind of wanted to have it both ways, where it kind of still wanted to look filmy in some places, but then it would, you know, go with the full on digital for some of the stuff, and I don't know, that was kind of distracting, where he hadn't actually decided to go to one side or the other.
There didn't seem...
In terms of shooting it.
If I had to guess, I would say that the studio wouldn't really let him, maybe. I don't know, shooting all on digital in 2001 would be pretty ballsy.
Yeah, yeah.
But...
There didn't seem to be really any connection between the scenes where he chose digital. Like, he didn't seem to really have any... There didn't seem to be like anything that linked those scenes together.
Yeah. Maybe it was like a thing where partway through the production he convinced them to be like, no, this is going to be cheaper and better. Like, Star Wars is doing it, we can do it. And then...
Oops.
So
Man, Star Wars looks so shoddy.
Yeah, it does. That's really gross.
I watched it 2 years ago, and it's almost impossible to look at, like, how bad.
What's that, Ruben?
Looks.
Sorry.
And just the new, or the last
yeah,
series of Star Wars
prequel,
movies.
Yeah, the prequel trilogy.
I watched them about 2 years ago, and it's just amazing how much money they put into those movies for them to look so bad.
It's true.
Like, it really looks like something that I could probably make with y'all, like, right now.
Yeah. But George Lucas was at the forefront. Without investing all that money, maybe digital photography wouldn't look as good as it does right now. But he spent, you know,
that's cool.
$200 million shooting a movie on 2001 era digital cameras, which is pretty crazy.
The new one looks pretty good, though.
All for the sake of those special effects.
New one does look good. I'm annoyed that I want to see it.
you and Linda both.
Yeah.
Little Jar Jar Abrams.
I wouldn't go so far as to say I'm annoyed, but I'm prepared to not like it, even though I want to see it.
I mean, I feel like J.J. Abrams...
I'm in crash position.
I feel like J.J. Abrams has already made a Star Wars movie. Like, the Star Trek movie, the first one, felt like a Star Wars movie.
I kind of like that movie.
Yeah, and I really like that movie. And I was like, this feels like Star Wars more than it feels like Star Trek. And a lot of other Star Trek fans have said that same thing. They're like, this is not a Star Trek movie, it's a Star Wars
yeah,
movie.
Good.
I was like, good, I like Star Wars more than
it's
Star
Trek.
It's
guns in space.
Star Wick.
Yeah.
Star Trars.
Star Trek.
Patrick, I think what you're ignoring, though, is that the most important part of Star Wars is the ability to call it a Star Wars movie and make billions of dollars off of it.
That's true, yeah. They can't merchandise it. They can't merchandise it as a Star Wars movie.
Star Trek made plenty of money, though.
It did. Yeah.
Both of them did. But,
yeah.
Well, I don't love those movies, but I do hope they're more, this new one is more in that vein than Super 8 or something.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, please.
But I worry because I think J.J. Abrams does like Star Wars a lot more than he likes Star Trek, and he even admitted that he wasn't much of a Star Trek fan growing up, and I feel like Super 8 is what happens when J.J. Abrams makes an ode to something he really loves.
Yeah, I saw an op-ed piece in The Guardian to that same effect. He was like, I'm not going to see the new Star Wars movie because J.J. Abrams is going to ruin it. And I was like,
Let people's cranky grandparents write op-eds now in The Guardian?
I guess so.
When you apply to write op-eds, you have to say how many grandchildren you have and how long you owned your house and things like that.
And how you feel about people on your front lawn.
Well, you can already tell that they're, like, above a certain age just by the fact that they're reading and writing in newspapers.
Yeah, Patrick, how old are you?
Well,
are you secretly an old person?
This is an online piece. I don't actually get The Guardian delivered to my house.
He's flip-flopping.
From England to California.
Flip-flopping.
Airdrop it on the front door.
Thanks, mate.
Yeah. So, I don't know. If we're J.J. Abrams directed films, I like the first Star Trek. I didn't like the second one, and I hate Super 8. If we want to include produced films, I did like Cloverfield quite a bit as well.
How do you feel about Mission Impossible 3?
Oh, I hate that movie.
I remember liking
not
it.
Not as
I
much as
it.
Super 8, but I do dislike that movie quite a bit.
I think I would have
the whole love story thing in any of the Mission Impossible movies is really beyond me, and they really play it up in that one. At least in the first one, Brian De Palma was smart enough to make it a fake out.
It's true. Yeah, J.J. Abrams does it the opposite way, in a gross way, where you think she got murdered, but then turns out, phew, she's safe. It's just some other woman that got shot in the head.
What a relief.
Pop, pop. Fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is.
That your wife didn't get murdered.
Yep. That's the Alka-Seltzer guarantee. Someone else got murdered.
It wasn't actually
your Mission Impossible movies murdered. Will probably start getting better now that Tom Cruise is too old to be a credible love interest in an action movie.
They'll keep pushing it. I think. They made a movie where Fred Astaire seduces Audrey Hepburn when he was like 60. She was like 21.
Love in the Afternoon is the same deal. Gary Cooper's so old and Audrey Hepburn is so young in that.
I mean, what was the age difference between Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt in Edge of Tomorrow?
Pretty high.
I would guess 20-something years.
Yeah, probably.
She's like 32, 33. How old is Tom Cruise?
He's at least 50-something. But... Yeah.
Emily Blunt is 32.
But there isn't that much of a romance in the new Mission Impossible.
No, and it was really good, actually.
Yeah, I think,
I don't know. Basil did.
Same with Ghost Protocol. I didn't like either of those, though.
I really liked Ghost Protocol.
I really like the sandstorm scene in Ghost Protocol. It's my favorite part of any Mission Impossible movie, but other than that,
I'm not a big fan of it. I flip around. Like, that's actually the scene that I like the least in that movie. And I love all the rest
Whatever.
Of
them. You're a terrible person.
Whatever. You don't like Jeremy Renner saying, next time I seduce the rich guy? I thought that was pretty funny.
I don't remember that part. And I just watched that movie very recently.
when he's got to go through the like air shaft that's shooting lava at him or whatever, he just goes, next time I seduce the rich guy, because he's got to do the hardest thing. And I thought that was pretty funny.
Also, I like the part where exploit her sexuality,
hanging off the side of the building, and where they have the fight scene at the tall building. And
I mean, starting from there up through the sandstorm stuff is the best part of the movie, in my opinion. I also like when that one woman, Paula Patton, maybe kicks Leia Seydoux out the window.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. Yeah, that fight scene where she kicks her out the window.
I don't like that joke. I find it too mean.
I didn't think it was a joke.
I thought that was the character was just so mad at her for killing her boyfriend.
Yeah, but it's like played for a laugh because Simon Pegg or whoever is like running in saying like that you have to keep her alive or like don't do it or whatever, and then she just like kicks her off and it's really unceremonious, and I feel like that was a joke.
I forgot about the other part. I was just like, she's pissed at her.
Yeah.
She's pissed at that character.
Yeah, if it was played as like
it was a joke. I took it as like Paul Patton is not a good person.
None of the people in those movies are good people.
None of them are.
No, that's the point. That's the very minor through line of Ghost Protocol that I kind of like. Like in the beginning when he's just beating up those Russian prisoners endlessly.
It sure does.
But I also like the last fight scene in that movie where they're just like breaking their legs to get to the like the suitcase to stop the missiles or whatever. Like they're just like breaking parts of their body. I thought it was really funny though, because you usually like see people have fights like that and they like get up and they're fine or whatever. In that scene they're just like just like crawling toward the button.
My complaint about that scene is stupid, but I still feel like there's no satisfactory way to answer how, like, a super government-trained agent would have trouble fighting a prisoner. They should have had, like, a bodyguard or something that was, like, he could have been, like, the last
tweed jacket gives him +1 to saving throws.
the old professor dude, he's been secretly training for years, and he's older than Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise is an incredible action hero, but we're supposed to take this guy, can beat up Tom Cruise, even though he's like 15 years older than him. Yeah, maybe they should have put like handcuffs on Tom Cruise's legs, then I would have found the fight.
Wasn't
credible.
Tom Cruise hurt at the beginning of the fight? I can't remember. I seem to remember he has some sort of like handicap during the fight. I know that they like break the.
Or they could have done Ruben's idea, but had the other guy there too. Like if Tom Cruise had to fight two different people at the same time, and one of them's like a bodyguard guy, then it would be pretty believable that Tom Cruise would also get his
ass beat. It's pretty unbelievable that a fight would go that way anyway. Like, usually real fights are just like chaos. They're just like, just people grabbing each other like that. So
that's why the Keith David Roddy Piper fight and they live. That's the greatest fight in cinema history.
That is really good.
Because every time you think that it's over, it goes on for like another minute and a half.
Every fight in a movie should be modeled after the Hell in the Cell match between Mankind and Undertaker.
Yeah, everything should look like professional wrestling in movies.
Speaking of things that take place in rings... Is there anything, y'all?
And we brought it back to boxing.
To say about Ali before we wrap this up?
I was gonna say that I'm embarrassed that my knowledge of history was so sort of scattershot that I forgot that Ali actually wins this one, and I thought that was like a because I only remember George Foreman beating him later, or at the time only remembered that. So I was like, oh, it's kind of cool that like the climactic fight. Is one that he loses, but then he won it, and I was like, oh, never mind. I guess he lost to George Foreman.
They already did that in Rocky.
Yeah.
That's true. But Rocky was never trying to win. He was just trying to make it to the end.
If you want to see a better boxing movie, go see the original Rocky.
I would probably agree that that is a better boxing movie, although I haven't seen it in a long time.
It's great.
Have you ever seen it?
Like I'm punching the meat.
Did you know that Sylvester Stallone wrote that movie in an apartment very near where Howard Kramer lives?
Huh. I did know that, but I was the only one.
I guessed that he probably wrote it in an apartment, but I didn't know it was near where Howard Kramer lived.
That's a great movie. It's super underrated.
For a best picture winner.
Well,
he actually
among a certain groups of people.
Yeah.
I mean, he wrote it based on a later Ali fight, the one where he got knocked down by that like nobody guy. That's the guy he was writing the movie about, which was that nobody who actually knocked Ali down, but then lost the fight.
Huh.
I can't remember that guy's name, but there is an ESPN 30 for 30 about him called The Real Rocky.
While we're on the subject, let's all go see Creed and do it for the podcast.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at boxing movies, and I haven't seen a lot of them, but I'm going to say that right now my favorite is probably Real Steel.
Yeah. Nice.
What about Robot Jocks? Does that count?
I don't think so. That's not really boxing. That's more like robot fighting.
I also like...
Real Steel actually takes place at a boxing ring.
Walter Hill's Hard Times.
Fat City, is that boxing?
It was listed.
Fat
I haven't
City
seen
is
it
really
though.
Good. Fat City and Rocky.
Box.
All right, everyone. So what to take away from this podcast is see Fat City, Rocky, Real Steel, and Hard Times.
Snake Eyes. It's not really a boxing movie, but I do like the boxing stuff in it. A lot.
There's not that much boxing in Snake Eyes, but that's definitely my favorite movie with boxing in it.
I thought you were going to say that's definitely my favorite movie for a second.
It's close. It's like 73rd. It's up there.
That's relatively close.
It's my favorite
close.
Brian De Palma movie.
It's my second favorite based on the ones I've seen. Recently-ish.
After Carrie or Blowout?
Carrie. Blowout was never my favorite. That was always like in the like number 5 to 6 spot.
Really? Blowout's my favorite, I think.
Yeah, my... my three faves for a while were Hi Mom, Snake Eyes, and Carrie, but when I rewatched Hi Mom, I didn't like it as much, so now it's out of the canon, except for it's still in our canon.
That's true.
There were no vetoes in the last canon.
That's true. I wouldn't have vetoed it anyway, because I hadn't seen it again yet.
Yeah.
That's
I might have vetoed your veto.
It's an interesting conversation to have. What would you have vetoed from the first canon?
I would have vetoed the apartment before that.
Yeah. You sure would have.
Because I rewatched it and didn't really like it, as opposed to Hi Mom, which I just still sort of liked, but not nearly as much.
The only movie on the canon that I did not like is La Noire de, but I still wouldn't have vetoed it because it would have just made our canon even more white and male than it already was.
I was like,
this is my least favorite Usman Sembin film, but I'd rather have Usman Sembin on here than not.
Should have seen Imitai for that one.
Yeah.
But then we wouldn't have gotten to podcast about it.
What would you veto from our canon, Michael?
I don't know if I remember the whole thing, to be honest.
What?
Is there anything
that
pops into my
eye? No. Where's that button? I need to eject.
You didn't pour... You didn't pour over our canon?
Ah.
That's good.
Good times.
What about Patrick? He hasn't said anything.
What would I veto from our first canon? I'm going to look it over.
Rules of the Game?
No. I liked Rules of the Game. I didn't... I wouldn't say it's one that I'm just like, meh, get it out of here. I liked it. That was pretty good. Let's see here. I'm just gonna take a look. See.
This is good podcasting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We're doing it up. Listen to Patrick click on stuff.
Seinfeld style podcast.
I'm clicking on stuff too.
Yep. We're all clicking.
That's technically always true. Time indefinite?
No, I was definitely one of the people that had that in my top 10.
You might have vetoed Fat Girl, Basil.
That's true, although I changed my mind on that movie. I think it made me really upset when I first watched it, but then I was like, eh, it's kind of cool that it made me that upset.
Love to be upset.
Hmm.
If you had vetoed Resident Evil Retribution, I would have vetoed your existence.
No, I was excited that one was on there, even though
that was fun.
I still like it, but
yeah, I might have vetoed His Girl Friday. I don't know. Maybe.
Well, you're wrong.
Well,
it's a good movie.
Well, you're wrong about The Apartment.
That might also be true. Billy Wilder sure loves suicide. It's a real funny plot point.
I don't know, I looked over it and I like every film except for Black Girl.
It's a pretty good list.
I'll have to watch Trouble in Paradise, but I don't think I loved
I haven't seen that in a really long time. I didn't like it when I first watched it.
Or not to be, I might have vetoed from Ilya's list on this last canon after I watched it this time, so I'll have to go back and watch Trouble in Paradise because I might feel like
might just
not
be
like
a Lubitscher.
Yeah, might not be a fan of Vince Lubitsch. I don't know though. It seems like the subject matter is kind of what I had the most trouble with in to be or not to be. Because I thought the way the comedy worked was pretty funny, but I thought it was like the subject matter is really like, oh, there's a joke in here about somebody being called concentration camp. I forget what his name is, but they call him concentration camp Earhart. That's his name. But they keep laughing about that, and I'm like, that's a horrible thing for somebody to be called. Why are we laughing about that?
Those theater people, they're so disaffected.
So wacky. Yeah.
They're like morticians.
They gloss over people being murdered and whatnot, you know.
Anyway. So get back to Ali again, maybe. Does anyone else have anything?
I don't. I didn't take very many notes on this one, and I pretty much went over them, so.
Yep. I took a lot of notes, as is my tendency when I'm not enjoying a movie that much, but.
I've exhausted everything I had to say about this movie.
Oh. Well, I'll just say one last thing, which is, in terms of more, I guess, celebrity might not be the right word, but, like, more people being referenced for reasons that I couldn't quite understand. Near the very end of the movie, they reference Idi Amin, and I was like, oh, is like the coup going to happen like now? But then it doesn't happen now. It's just like later, because it's before he's the dictator of the country. When he's just a general, but they're like, General Amin. And I was like, oh, but what does this have to do with Muhammad Ali fighting?
Yeah, that came out of nowhere completely.
The answer is, I don't know.
It's just another example of how the movie is just... I think Mann tried to take on way too much with this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the part that's in French?
Yes.
But there was no subtitles?
I believe so, yes.
Because I was like, why are there no subtitles here? I could understand parts of it. But I was like, what's going on? Was that supposed to be like an American government official talking to Idi Amin?
Yeah. Was there no subtitles?
Mine didn't have any, but I had turned subtitles off on my copy.
Yeah, I
suspect that if you watched the actual...
I had subtitles on and they didn't appear.
Yeah.
Oh, really? It was just like...
It just didn't have anything there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Maybe Michael Mann just loves fidelity to linguistics, so... If you don't speak the language, sorry. You're out of luck.
You intentionally don't get to understand what's going on in the scene.
Hey, everyone. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think it can be fun when directors do that intentionally, but I don't know. Maybe if you actually watch it on the DVD, there are.
Didn't Charlie Chaplin do that in Modern Times? Or... It's like supposed to be the first time that he's ever spoken on film, but he's singing in French instead of in English. So it's kind of like a funny joke. He was like, ha ha, can't understand it.
I do remember that part. It's a good gag.
Yeah. It's my favorite part of the movie, probably.
Even more than the roller skating?
Yeah.
I mean, that's fair. They're both good parts, but I do like the roller skating a lot.
Despite what you said on the podcast about it being like, really looking like it was a big drop, I could pretty easily tell that it was painted, personally.
Bummer.
I mean, it was still cool, but...
Less scary.
I guess so.
I just remember it being funny as all. Like, that's...
My favorite part was the woman. Actually.
Whoa, man. My favorite part is whoa, man.
I love when there's the close-up of her face after they've stolen all the bananas. And she's like, has this, like, windswept hair. And then she just takes a big bite of banana. Anyway.
All right.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the podcast. We hope you're enjoying it. Please subscribe using your podcast listening app or on iTunes on your computer, if that's how you like to roll. And if you don't already have an iTunes account, sign up for one. get on a desktop and give us a 5-star review. We really do appreciate it, and it really does help our egos. And man, they are too small. They need to get bigger. I'd like to thank Michael for joining tonight to talk about Ali. I'm sorry you didn't enjoy the movie, but that just is what happens to you. You never enjoy
the
movie.
It's just the way she goes.
Mm-hmm. You just... if you thought we had anything else to say about Ali, you were and are myth taken. Oh, wait. Wrong podcast. we'll see you next time.
Didn't you make this joke last time?
No, I did. Who charted?
Oh, right. Just do a sign off from a different podcast at the end of every single one.
I don't listen to enough podcasts.
Make
to
sure
do
you
that.
Get your dog and cat spayed and neutered.
Thanks for making it weird, y'all.
Keep it crispy.
Keep it crispy.
So crispy. I'm so crispy.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye, guys.
I could probably hit the stop recording button now.